Well, thank you. Bob and Terry both, I said as I walked in, this is an adult audience today, I see. you wouldn't know you're on a university campus without any of them are enrolled. It is a pleasure to be here. When I moved to San Diego in 1988, indeed I discovered that it, same thing as it was when I was in the Navy, sort of a hellhole, but nonetheless, there was one thing going on in the neighborhood that was extremely useful to me, and that was this seminar that Professor Brinner and Perry Anderson and others created here. And I've always felt it a real honor to be invited and a pleasure to be back. Let me lay out a few ideas for discussion today. I'm not going to cover all topics that Bob Brinner raised. The military adventurers of the Bush administration have much in common with the corporate leaders of the defunct energy company Enron. Both groups of men thought they were the smartest guys in the room, which is, of course, the title of Alex Gibney's prize-winning film on what went wrong at Enron. The neoconservatives in the White House and the Pentagon outsmarted themselves. They failed even to address the problem of how to finance their schemes of imperialist wars and global dominion. As a result, a half century after starting down this path, the United States finds itself in the anomalous position of being unable to pay for its own elevated living standards or its wasteful, overly large military establishment. The U.S. government no longer even attempts to reduce the ruinous expenses of maintaining huge standing armies, replacing the equipment that 7 years of war have destroyed or worn out, or preparing for a war in outer space against unknown adversaries. Instead, the Bush administration puts off these costs for future generations to pay or repudiate. This utter fiscal irresponsibility has been disguised through many manipulative financial schemes, such as causing poorer countries to lend us unprecedented sums of money. But the time of reckoning is fast approaching. There are three broad aspects to our debt crisis. First, in the current fiscal year, 2008, we're spending insane amounts of money on, quote, defense projects that bear no relationship to the national security of the United States. Simultaneously, we are keeping the income tax burdens on the richest segments of the American population at strikingly low levels. Second, we continue to believe that we can compensate for the accelerating erosion of our manufacturing base and our loss of jobs to foreign countries through massive military expenditures, so-called military Keynesianism, as I use that phrase in Nemesis. By military Keynesianism, I mean the mistaken belief that public policies focused on frequent wars, huge expenditures on weapons and munitions, and large standing armies can indefinitely sustain a wealthy capitalist economy. The opposite is actually true. Third, in our devotion to militarism, in spite of our limited resources, we are failing to invest in our social infrastructure and other requirements for the long-term health of our country. These are what economists call opportunity costs, things not done because we spent our money on something else. Our public education system has deteriorated alarmingly. We have failed to provide health care to all our citizens and neglected our responsibilities as the world's number one polluter. Most important, we have lost our competitiveness as a manufacturer for civilian needs, an infinitely more efficient use of scarce resources than arms manufacturing. So let me quickly discuss each of these, beginning first with the current fiscal disaster. It is virtually impossible to overstate the profligacy of what our government spends on the military. The Department of Defense's planned expenditures for fiscal year 2008 are larger than all other nations' military budgets combined. The supplementary budget to pay for the current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is, of course, not part of the official defense budget, is itself larger than the combined military budgets of Russia and China. Defense-related spending for fiscal 2008 will exceed $1 trillion for the first time in history. A trillion is 1,000 billion. It's a number that's almost impossible to conceive. The United States has become the largest single salesman of arms and munitions to other nations on Earth. Leaving out of account President Bush's two ongoing wars, defense spending has doubled since the mid-1990s. The defense budget for fiscal 2008 is the largest since World War II. Before we try to break down and analyze this gargantuan sum, there's one important caveat. Figures on defense spending are notoriously unreliable. They're simply not accurate, and you cannot know with any detail precisely what they are. The numbers released by the Congressional Reference Service and the Congressional Budget Office do not agree with each other. Robert Higgs, Senior Fellow for Political Economy at the Independent Institute, says, and I quote, "A well-founded rule of thumb is to take the Pentagon's always well-publicized basic budget total and double it." Even a cursory reading of newspaper articles about the Department of Defense will turn up major differences in statistics about its expenses. Moreover, some 30 to 40% of the defense budget is black, meaning that these sections contain hidden expenditures for classified projects. There's no possible way to know what they include or where or whether their total amounts are accurate. The CIA's budget, for example, is and always has been, since it was created in 1947, hidden in the Air Force budget under miscellaneous aircraft. There are many reasons for this budgetary sleight of hand, including a desire for secrecy on the part of the President, the Secretary of Defense, and the military-industrial complex. But the chief one is that members of Congress, who profit enormously from defense jobs and pork barrel projects in their districts, have a political interest in supporting the Department of Defense. I would argue that probably one of the greatest crimes of the military-industrial complex in America has been to corrupt the Congress, to the point that it is almost impossible to discuss the issue, and you can go into just anecdotal detail forever. The two mother hens of the Defense Facilities Subcommittee of the Senate Armed Services Committee are Kay Bailey Hutchinson of Texas and Dianne Feinstein of California. The states with the largest number of military bases, their function in life is to keep those bases open. They'll do anything in their power to achieve just that. They're good at it. But as I say, the black budgets are, the classic example, I've used it, I guess, 100 times, it shouldn't keep it up, but the state of Washington has two lovely liberal female senators, well-educated, quite smart, and pleasant to talk to. Before your very eyes, they will pull a Jekyll and Hyde and turn into bloodlusting fascist hyenas if you should say to any one of them the word Boeing. Boeing is the signal. There's a potential enemy out there. And that there would go my continued tenure in the Congress. They say Congress has a political interest in supporting the Department of Defense and in not having this information reported accurately. Despite the first article, like the clause of the Constitution that guarantees all citizens ultimately an accurate accounting of how their tax dollars were spent. That has not been true since the Manhattan Project of World War II. The Supreme Court has been unbelievably creative in avoiding the issue. In 1996, in an attempt to bring accounting standards within the executive branch somewhat closer to those of the civilian economy, Congress passed the Federal Fiscal Management Improvement Act. It required all federal agencies to hire outside auditors to review their books and release the results to the public. Neither the Department of Defense nor the Department of Homeland Security has ever complied. Congress has complained but not penalized either department for ignoring the law. The result is that all numbers released by the Pentagon must be regarded as suspect. We don't have them, and even if you were a uniformed military officer top secret compartmentalized information accessible clearance, you couldn't get it all. In discussing the fiscal 2008 defense budget as released to the press on February 7th of this year, I've been guided by two experienced and reliable analysts, William Hartung of the New America Foundation and Fred Kaplan, defense correspondent of Slate.org. They agree that the Department of Defense requested $481.4 billion for salaries, operations, except in Iraq and Afghanistan, and equipment. They also agree on a figure of $141.7 billion for the supplemental budget to fight the global war on terrorism. That is, the two ongoing wars that the general public may think are actually covered by the basic Pentagon budget. The Department of Defense also asked for an extra $93.4 billion to pay for hitherto unmentioned war costs in the remainder of 2007. And most creatively, it asked for an additional, quote, allowance, a new term in defense budget documents, of $50 billion to be charged to fiscal year 2009. This comes to a total spending request by the Department of Defense of $766.5 billion. But there is much more. That's just the Department of Defense. In an attempt to disguise the true size of the American military empire, the government has long hidden major military-related expenditures in departments other than defense. For example, over $20 billion for the Department of Energy goes toward developing and maintaining nuclear warheads. $25 billion in the Department of State budget is spent on foreign military assistance, primarily for Israel, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, United Arab Republic, Egypt, and Pakistan. Another billion outside the official Department of Defense budget is now needed for recruitment and reenlistment incentives for the overstretched U.S. military itself, up from a mere $174 million in 2003, the year the war in Iraq began. The Department of Veterans Affairs currently gets at least $75 billion, 50% of which goes for the long-term care of the grievously injured among the at least 28,870 soldiers so far wounded in Iraq and another 1,708 in Afghanistan. The amount is universally derided as inadequate. Another $46.4 billion goes to the Department of Homeland Security, which is, of course, created because the Department of Defense was uninterested in defense. Missing as well from this compilation is almost $2 billion to the Department of Justice for the paramilitary activities of the FBI, close to $40 billion to the Department of the Treasury for the Military Retirement Fund, $7.5 billion for the military-related activities of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and well over $200 billion in interest for past debt-financed defense outlays going back to 1960. This brings U.S. spending for its military establishment during the current fiscal year, 2008, conservatively calculated to at least $1.1 trillion. That's and I put the numbers on the board for you to compare it with. Let me turn to military Keynesianism. Such expenditures are not only morally obscene, they're fiscally unsustainable. Many neoconservatives and poorly informed patriotic Americans believe that even though our defense budget is huge, we can afford it because we're the richest country on earth. Unfortunately, that statement is no longer true. The world's richest political entity, according to the CIA's World Factbook, is the European Union. The EU's 2006 GDP, its gross domestic product, all goods and services produced domestically, was estimated to be slightly larger than that of the United States. However, China's 2006 GDP was only slightly smaller than that of the U.S., and Japan is the world's fourth richest nation. A more telling comparison that reveals just how much worse we're doing can be found among the current accounts of various nations. The current account measures the net trade surplus or deficit of a country, plus cross-border payments of interest, royalties, dividends, capital gains, foreign aid, and other income. For example, in order for Japan to manufacture anything, it must import all required raw materials. Even after this incredible expense is met, it still has an $88 billion per year trade surplus with the United States and enjoys the world's second highest current account balance. China is number one. The United States, by contrast, is number 163, dead last on the list, worse than countries like Australia and the United Kingdom that also have very large trade deficits. The United States' 2006 current account deficit was $811.5 billion. Second worst was Spain at $106.4 billion. This is what's unsustainable about the situation. I mean, as Herb Klein, when he was Nixon's chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, rather famously once said, things that can't go on forever don't. And that's the situation. It's not just that our tastes for foreign goods, including imported oil, vastly exceed our ability to pay for them. We're financing them through massive borrowing. On November 7th of last year, the U.S. Treasury announced the national debt had breached $9 trillion for the first time ever. This was just 5 weeks after Congress raised the so-called debt ceiling to $9.8 trillion. If you begin in 1789, at the moment the Constitution became the supreme law of the land, the debt accumulated by the federal government did not top $1 trillion until 1981. It's a contemporary problem, this overspending. When George Bush became president in January of 2001, it stood at approximately $5.7 trillion. Since then, it's increased by 45%. This huge debt can be largely explained by our defense expenditures in comparison with the rest of the world. I put on the board the top military spenders and the approximate amounts each country currently budgets for its military establishment. These are CIA figures. The world totals, yes, I mean, the United States spends more than anybody else. Our excessive military expenditures did not occur just over a few short years or simply because of the Bush administration's policies. They've been going on for a very long time, in accordance with a superficially plausible ideology, and have now become entrenched in our democratic political system, where they're starting to wreak havoc. This ideology I call military Keynesianism. Let me make it clear, Keynes never ever used the phrase, didn't like it, didn't understand it. It was invented by an exiled Polish economist during World War II to explain the German fiscal miracle. By military Keynesianism, I mean the determination to maintain a permanent war economy and to treat military output as an ordinary economic product, even though it makes no contribution to either consumption or production. This ideology goes back to the first years that is in the United States.
Is the speaker working?
Oh, what happened? Did I kick something loose? To the right?
Yeah, there you go.
Well, my right?
Your left.
Oh, my left. Oh, okay.
It still hasn't affected web. No. It may be well placed, but the sound hasn't improved. That is, it hasn't happened yet.
Has it happened yet?
No.
It hasn't happened yet. It hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, are we still plugged in? Plugged in?
Yeah.
Sorry, Chuck. No, it's pretty all right. I'll
recoup
a little bit.
You might as well be.
Can you hear anything? Okay, fine. Pardon me? Yeah, the room is full. Okay. Yeah, I think maybe we see if those things are plugged in.
Properly. Just because of. We use such high-tech equipment.
It's a third world country.
Yeah.
Okay, but go ahead.
The decline of the public sector.
Right. The ideology that I'm calling military Keynesianism goes back to the first years of the Cold War. During the late 1940s, the United States was haunted by economic anxieties. The Great Depression of the 1930s had been overcome only by the war production boom of World War II. With peace and demobilization, there was a pervasive fear that the Depression would return. During 1949, alarmed by the Soviet Union's detonation of an atomic bomb, the looming communist victory in the Chinese Civil War, a domestic recession, and the lowering of the Iron Curtain around the USSR's European satellites, the United States sought to draft basic strategy for the emerging Cold War. The result was the militaristic document, National Security Council Report 68, NSC 68, drafted under the supervision of Paul Nitze, then head of the policy planning staff in the State Department. It's dated April 14, 1950, and signed by President Truman on September 30, 1950. It laid out the basic public economic policies that the United States pursues to the present moment. In its conclusions, NSC 68 asserted, "One of the most significant lessons of our World War II experience was that the American economy, when it operates at a level approaching full efficiency, can provide enormous resources for purposes other than civilian consumption, while simultaneously providing a high standard of living. With this understanding, American strategists began to build up a massive munitions industry, both to counter the military might of the Soviet Union, which they consistently overstated, it always was overstated, and also to maintain full employment, as well as ward off a possible return of the Depression. The result was that under Pentagon leadership, entire new industries were created to manufacture large aircraft, nuclear-powered submarines, nuclear warheads, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and surveillance and communications satellites. This led to what President Eisenhower warned against in his farewell address of February 1961, the conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. This is what distinguishes contemporary American imperialism from the turn-of-the-century version from the world of Theodore Roosevelt. That is, the military-industrial complex. From 1947 to 1990, the combined U.S. military budgets amounted to well over $8 trillion. Even though the Soviet Union no longer exists, the U.S. reliance on military Keynesianism has, if anything, ratcheted up, thanks to the massive vested interests that have become entrenched around the military establishment. Over time, a commitment to both guns and butter has proven an unstable configuration. Military industries crowd out the civilian economy and lead to severe economic weaknesses. Devotion to military Keynesianism is, in fact, a form of slow economic suicide. Last May, the Center for Economic Policy and Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., released a study prepared by the global forecasting company Global Insight on the long-term economic impact of increased military spending. Guided by the economist Dean Baker, this research showed that after an initial demand stimulus, by about the sixth year, the effect of increased military spending turns negative. Needless to say, the U.S. economy has had to cope with growing defense spending for over 60 years. He found that after 10 years of higher defense spending, there would be 464,000 fewer jobs than in a baseline scenario that involved lower defense spending. Baker writes, "It is often believed that wars and military spending increases are good for the economy. In fact, most economic models show that military spending diverts resources from productive uses, such as consumption and investment, and ultimately slows economic growth and reduces employment. These are only some of the many deleterious effects of military Keynesianism, which continues at the present time." There's many ways to illustrate military Keynesianism, and above all it is, I think, in the competition for defense plants, military bases, military expenditures among members of Congress. Many of you might remember that I live in the 50th district of California, that's San Diego, and it's Randy Duke Cunningham. Randy Duke is spending 8.5 years in federal prison for bribing the MZM Corporation and a few others, using bribes to Cunningham for the sake of these defense contractors. I had published a piece in the L.A. Times, just an op-ed, based simply on Cunningham's submissions to the Federal Election Commission, saying that he was entirely bought and paid for by the military-industrial complex. His biggest contributors were easily Lockheed Martin and Boeing. The thing that interested me about this, and this is well before the federal district attorney had gone after Cunningham, I received several letters from the 34th district of Los Angeles, places like that, central parts of this part of the country, people saying, "God, I wish you were my congressman. I need a good job." That's what we do in this country, is make cluster bombs and drop them on Lebanese children. They like to play with the things until it's too late. It struck me then how deeply entrenched the military-industrial complex actually was. Moreover, how clever they are on a really big project like the B-1 bomber. They put a piece of that in every district possible. so that if you should threaten the congressman, we're going to vote you out of office next time because of your stance, he can be removed. It's perfectly logical for the Secretary of Defense to want to close redundant military facilities, some of them going back to the Civil War, and they're worthless. Just let him try it. I guarantee you the howls that arise at once from attempting to close, say, the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard, from every clergyman, every newspaper, every local university, save our jobs, keep the base open. They know that with great precision. It's one of the reasons why we have over 800 American military bases in other people's countries. Let me turn to the third item and bring this to conclusion, the hollowing out of the American economy. It was believed that the United States could afford both a massive military establishment and a high standard of living, and that it needed both to maintain full employment. But it did not work out that way. By the 1960s, it was becoming apparent that turning over the nation's largest manufacturing enterprises to the Department of Defense and producing goods without any consumption or investment value was starting to crowd out civilian economic activities. The historian Thomas Woods, Jr. observes that during the 1950s and 1960s, between one-third and two-thirds of all American research talent was siphoned off into the military sector. It is, of course, impossible to know what innovations never appeared as a result of this diversion of resources and brain power into the service of the military. But it was during the 1960s that we first began to notice Japan was outpacing us in the design and quality of a range of consumer goods, including household electronics and automobiles, and were leaving us in the dust. Nuclear weapons furnish a striking illustration of these anomalies. Between the 1940s and 1996, according to a now famous Brookings Institution study, the United States spent at least $5.8 trillion on the development, testing, and construction of nuclear bombs. By 1967, the peak year of the nuclear stockpile, the United States possessed some 32,500 deliverable atomic and hydrogen bombs, none of which, thankfully, of course, was ever used. But they illustrate perfectly the Keynesian principle that the government can provide make-work jobs to keep people employed. I mean, that's Keynes advocated seeding disused mines with gold and then paying people to go in and dig it up. This put them back to work, and it was a way to prime the pump. I mean, he believed in counter-cyclical spending. And it was a perfect Keynesian device. Nuclear weapons were not just America's secret weapon, but also its secret economic weapon. As of 2006, we still had 9,960 of them. There is today no sane use for them, while the trillions spent of them could have been used to solve the problems of Social Security and health care, quality education, and access to higher education for all, not to speak of the retention of highly skilled jobs within the American economy. The pioneer in analyzing what has been lost as a result of military Keynesianism was the late Seymour Melman, a professor of industrial engineering and operations research at Columbia University. His 1970 book, Pentagon Capitalism, The Political Economy of War, was a prescient analysis of the unintended consequences of the American preoccupation with its armed forces and their weaponry since the onset of the Cold War. Melman wrote, from 1946 to 1969, the United States government spent over $1,000 billion, that is $1 trillion, on the military, and more than half of this under the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. This sum of staggering size, try to visualize a billion of something, writes Melman, does not express the cost of the military establishment to the nation as a whole. The true cost is measured by what has been foregone, by the accumulated deterioration in many facets of life, by the inability to alleviate human wretchedness of long duration. The fact that we did not modernize or replace our capital assets is one of the main reasons why, by the turn of the century, our manufacturing base had all but evaporated. Machine tools, an industry on which Melman was an authority, are a particularly important symptom. In November of 1968, a five-year inventory, that's 1968, it's a long time ago now, a five-year inventory disclosed that 64% of the metalworking machine tools used in U.S. industry were 10 years old or older. The age of this industrial equipment, that is drills, lathes, things of that sort, marks the United States' machine tool stock as the oldest among all major industrial nations, and it marks the continuation of a deterioration process that began with the end of the Second World War. This deterioration at the base of the industrial system certifies to the continuous debilitating and depleting effect that the military use of capital and research and development talent has had on American industry. Nothing has been done in the period since 1968 to reverse these trends, and it shows today in our massive imports of equipment, from medical machines like proton accelerators for radiological therapy. They're made entirely in Belgium, Germany, and Japan, but not in the United States. We don't know how to make one, to cars and trucks. Our short tenure as the world's lone superpower has come to an end. As Harvard economics professor Benjamin Friedman has written, and I quote, "Again and again, it has always been the world's leading lending country that has been the premier country in terms of political influence, diplomatic influence, and cultural influence. It is no accident that we took over the role from the British at the same time that we took over the job of being the world's leading lending country. Today, we are no longer the world's leading lending country. In fact, we are the world's biggest debt country. And we are continuing to wield influence on the basis of military prowess alone. Some of the damage can never be rectified. There are, however, some steps that this country urgently needs to take. These include reversing Bush's 2001-2003 tax cuts for the wealthy, beginning to liquidate our global empire of over 800 military bases, cutting from the defense budget all projects that bear no relationship to the national security of the United States, and ceasing to use the defense budget as a Keynesian jobs program. If we do these things, we have a chance of squeaking by. If we don't, we face probable national insolvency and a long depression. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sarah Ann.
I don't know.
It's starting to work again.
Okay, so we only do this for members of our center. Our discussant for today, we only have one formal presenter. Our discussant for today is Perry Anderson, who obviously needs no introduction. Dean Parks. Perry is a professor of history here at UCLA and has long been at the core of our Center for Social Theory and Comparative History. He originated the plan of since 1980.